Welcome to the Fuller Money Audio Commentary. This is David Fuller on Friday, the 3rd of September, recording at 9:10 p.m., and that's British Summer Time. Now, a quick look at the week's highlights, as this is the big picture long-term outlook for the various asset classes. In terms of stock markets, it's been a firm week overall, with the Asian markets steady. Led by some quite good strength in the ASEAN markets, including today. European stock markets have rebounded quite sharply, helped with short covering. The U.S. stock market has also rebounded quite sharply, and that continued again today with the Dow, S&P and NASDAQ closing pretty much at the highs of the day, up 1.25% to 1.5%. And long-dated government bonds, they've taken quite a hit, but bond prices, so yields have spiked upwards, breaking their short-term downtrends. Bond prices breaking their short-term uptrends. The U.S. dollar's generally been a little bit softer, but not by much. And it's probably unchanged against sterling. I haven't looked at that chart recently. Currencies have not been the big feature here. The dollar did strengthen against the yen on the employment figures, but then gave up most of that. It's currently at 84.36. Precious metals were generally firm, although when the better employment figures came out, that did lead to a sell-off, most of which was recouped. I'll give you an example. For instance, gold fell down to 1237.78 from its earlier high of 1253.93. But it did bounce back, still closed down on the day, but it was at 1246.70 on the close. Industrial metals had a pretty good week, but with a little bit of profit taking in here today. Copper is at 350, and crude oil, it's been quite volatile. It's had a good bounce this week, gave up some ground here today. It's currently at 74.31, and the grain and bean complex has sprung back to life, particularly today. We saw very powerful gains here today for corn, soybeans, and wheat, and also oats. Okay, so what's going on generally? And what is the big picture outlook? Well, as far as stock markets are concerned, it has been fascinating and mildly stressful in the Western markets, because we've had these ranging patterns which are always a bit tedious. It's been quite Sisyphusian in that, having seen the boulder roll back down the hill during August, we've seen it pushed back up here quite sharply. I mean, in 4 days, the S&P has actually regained over two-thirds of its August decline. And perhaps one of the reasons for the speed of that recovery is that sentiment was exceptionally bearish. I called it irrationally pessimistic and gratuitously pessimistic, gratuitously on the part of people who were short and wanting to buy back lower. And so we've seen short covering, but it's a sufficiently strong rally to impress a good many people. and valuations were reasonably attractive. So this is looking a bit potent. It'll be fascinating to see what happens over the next week or two. But suffice it to say, people came back from their August holidays, those who had taken August holidays. There was a consensus view, certainly on Wall Street, that they would come back and sell. But we've seen nothing but buying in here. Now, overall, as I say, we're still range-bound, but I feel that that's a favorable overall background for the fourth quarter of this year and beyond, which I've long forecast would be a bullish period generally. And yes, the economic news is pretty diabolical, but we have the ultra-low interest rates. There is a fair amount of liquidity sloshing around. Equity valuations, where stock markets have been weak, have improved, particularly among big-cap multinational companies in the West, which on average yield considerably more than U.S. 10-year treasuries. So that's a favorable background. And as I've emphasized before in these audios, one isn't buying the economy. One's buying individual companies. And the ones that we favor in the West are the big-cap multinational companies that are leveraged to the global economy, and preferably from that group, those with decent dividend yields. And there are quite a few of them, and we've highlighted them in recent weeks. So that's not all that bad a picture, and I think that there's a lot of depression talk. Well, it depends a little bit, I suppose, on how you define a depression. It certainly isn't a depression like the 1930s, but that's because there is a very big safety net out there. And I've seen reports that 1 in 6 Americans is on some sort of income support, and that's not an attractive figure for the economy overall. We know that there's going to be more debt deleveraging taking place among consumers. We also know that government debt is at dangerously high levels. But a depression? Well, I would call it a severe credit recession. And as I've said before, 100 years of history show us that these credit crunches, credit crunch type recessions, usually are followed by slow recoveries. It takes about 5 to 7 years on average before economies recover from a significant credit crisis. Will it be double dip? Probably not, although it may feel like that for some people. But again, I emphasize that one's investing in individual stocks, and the stocks that we like are doing really quite well. Now, another positive indicator here is that the fuller money themes led by Asia, booming Asia, those stock markets have mostly been quite strong. The odd man out, and it's an important one, is China. But that's attributable really, I think, primarily to the heavy supply that has come on stream. Now, people will say, well, the government's been upping interest rates to squeeze property speculators and to curb a property bubble. Well, the way they've actually done that is that they have lifted the reserve requirements for the Chinese banks quite sharply. And in their solvency tests, they've also told them that they want balance sheets sufficiently strong so that the Chinese banks could absorb a 60% drop in property prices. That's not a forecast, at least not by me, and more importantly, not by the Chinese government. But what it does mean is that China has pressured those financial institutions to really strengthen their balance sheets. And that's something that the Western countries should have done well before their own property bubble burst. And if they had, the consequences would have been a lot less serious, and the bubble would have been reduced in terms of overall size. It never would have reached the heights that it actually reached. But the net result of this is that all that heavy supply has weighed on the Chinese stock market. Now, we see reports, and Owen's posted one of them here today, indicating that the supply is drying up, and China has seen a good saw a good rebound last month, and is steady here right now. And if that supply does dry up as anticipated, I would be quite optimistic that we would see a further improvement. Valuations, by China standards, are quite competitive. And so I like that I like that market. There's a some overheating in the ASEAN group, but not so much as to be a serious problem at this stage. Now, if we get food price inflation, and I'll come on to that in a moment, over the next 6 months or so, and that's a real risk. Then that may create a greater headwind. But let me pick up the government bonds, switch to the government bonds. This has been a momentum move. The bond buyers have been bolstering their spirits with talk of a depression and deflation, seeing no inflation whatsoever out there. I've described it as a bubble. And but obviously, anyone who's holding those bonds does not see it in the same light. In terms of technical action, and I think we can form some sort of objective agreement on that more easily. The downward dynamics by bond futures that we've seen this week, and therefore the corresponding upward dynamics that we have seen in bond yields this week, really have interrupted the trends. To put it conservatively, we've seen a bottom in the yields and a peak in the bond prices, bond futures prices, of at least near-term significance, of at least near-term significance. What is that evidence? Additional evidence of that? Well, look at a chart of 30-year U.S. Treasuries, for instance, or look at a chart of 30-year bunds. Look at the JGB's chart, and you will see that we have seen a bigger pullback over the last week than we had seen during previous pauses during this strong bull run for bonds. So I've maintained for a while that the so-called risk-free return was a return-free risk, and I think it's a dangerous market overall. And I think that there's more in store to worry bond investors than a sharp pullback from a considerably overbought position. Now, what might that be? Well, have a look at the weekly charts for wheat, corn, soybeans, and oats, and you will see massive base formations. You've probably seen them already. We've pointed them out on a number of occasions recently. And these markets are starting to trend. It happened last month with a big upward move by wheat. Tremendous move on the bad fundamental news coming out of Russia, that was drought conditions. Then wheat pulled back sharply, gave up about a third of that advance in what looks to me like a typical consolidation, and it's starting to strengthen once again, not hitting new highs, but it looks like it's probably completed the downside phase of its consolidation and is ready to move higher once again. Corn is very, very strong. Soybeans is lagging a little bit. Oats are firm. And rough rice has lagged. It has an atypical pattern without the big base formation. But it's coming off quite a cheap level overall, and there's plenty of scope there for price appreciation. Now, what would be the fundamentals behind that? Well, it's pretty much a perfect storm, starting with the Russian drought. There was some drought which really caused havoc with the spring wheat crop, and I'm also told that the winter wheat crop is in danger because the ground is very hard. The drought has continued. It's very hard to break it up for the plantings, and the cold weather is setting in. Time is short as far as the planting is concerned. China had a drought as well, which apparently damaged its corn yield. The U.S. corn crop, which was felt 2-3 months ago to be quite good, suffered in August because the nighttime temperatures were too hot, and when that happens, the sugars don't move up the stem and plump up the kernels, and so the yields are likely to be well down on forecasts of only a month or so ago, and China has been importing corn. The U.S. has been selling corn, but it may not have as much corn to sell as China and perhaps others wish to buy. Rounding out that perfect storm, there's that horrendous disaster in Pakistan with the flooding, which wiped out their crops and also damaged some of the holdover crops from the previous year, some of their reserves. India, which had the disastrous monsoon last year, was on course for a very good monsoon this year, but it hasn't turned out to be quite as good as previously expected. I think in five states there is still some problem with drought. So India will be okay, but it's not got the bumper crops. It's unlikely to have the bumper crops that were hoped for and had been predicted earlier on. So this is a fairly serious situation, and some people, including a very knowledgeable specialist in this field who's a member of the collective subscribers, thinks that we're going to see very substantial spikes, particularly in the wheat and corn prices. Now, if that does take place, that will be a big shock for bond bulls because, as I said before, they're only talking about deflation, and this would represent food price inflation, not wage price inflation. The only wage price inflation that we're seeing of consequence that I'm aware of is in China. But we're certainly not seeing that, and we're not going to see that in the West. But food price inflation would equal stagflation. So in other words, stagnant economies with very little growth, very slow growth, and insufficient growth in the U.S. to keep up with the job demands from a growing population, the job requirements from a growing population, and painfully higher food prices. Now, if that happens, as say, it will be an additional, well, it'll be a considerable shock for the bond investors. And I said yesterday, I thought that really the yield on those 10-year treasuries, which got down to, I think, around 2.4% in late August, that they'll move back up to 4 faster than people expect. So interesting times. Overall, I think the best investment potential by far is in equities. I think the best speculative potential is probably in the grain and bean complex, but a lot of other commodities look quite interesting as well. And the metals have certainly perked up. That's the industrial metals that I was talking about. They had a big shakeout earlier on during this ranging corrective phase, but have rebounded quite sharply. The precious metals have certainly firmed up, so one can't rule out a run to the upside, although for that to occur, it would have to interrupt the cycle of 18-month consolidations that we have seen on three occasions during the secular bull trend to date. See my big review yesterday on the precious metals if you are interested in that. That's in the comment of the day, of course, for yesterday. And crude oil prices, I think it's crude's cheap at these levels and very likely to push higher. The price was dragged down partly by an increase in storage, stored petroleum. And I'm told, though, that a lot of that represents crude oil that has come on shore that had previously been in tankers. Now, that crude's been around for a long time. It was there last year. And a good portion of that, is to say, has been moved to storage tanks onshore, and that's why those levels have gone up. And that actually demand for crude oil is really quite firm, and that shouldn't surprise us at all. So, I think the areas of upside potential, commodities. That probably still includes precious metals, and it certainly includes the industrial commodities. But most of all, I think probably the hottest candidates are the grain and bean complex for the reasons that I've just mentioned. I think stock markets still look set for a good year-end run in the fourth quarter, and that usually carries well on into the new year. Fuller money themes ought to continue to do quite well there, although we have to watch out for some overextension on some of the best performing stock markets overall. The area that I think is most dangerous is long-dated government bonds. Now people say, well, what about corporate bonds? And there are some attractive yields out there. Yes, but we're talking about junk bonds, and the name alone ought to represent a warning for you. Junk bonds have been around for a long time, and we've seen some enthusiastic buying and also some very, very painful setbacks in those markets. Also, we are in an environment of low interest rates generally, which has enabled some corporations to borrow very cheaply in the long-dated government bond markets. So again, this is a good picture for corporations because a lot of corporations are cash rich. Corporations that are not and want additional financing have been able to borrow quite cheaply for the most part. Any company with a good balance sheet has been able to borrow quite cheaply. Now, I'll just put it to you this way. If a company can borrow long-term money cheaply, and one example that I pointed out last month was, I forget the name of the company, but it borrowed it issued 100-year bonds, and I think they was my memory. I think the yield was just over 5.7%. Well, that's a mighty attractive or mighty low yield, rather, mighty low yield on a 100-year bond. What's going to happen to the price of that bond when interest rates start to move up again over time? Well, obviously, price of that bond will fall back really very sharply. Now, my point is that if it's an ideal borrowing environment for companies, because rates are low and they're likely to move up over the medium to longer term, is that a good opportunity for long-side investors? Obviously not. And last but not least, what about currencies in this environment? I think the currency, unquestionably, the currency that is most out of line and causing the most problems on a global basis for its country is the Japanese yen. And Japanese corporate Japan, led by Mr. Suzuki of Suzuki, is screaming about this. The government has been, it's been a zombie government, as I've described it. There is an election later this month because the current sitting prime minister is being challenged, and the candidate running against him says that he will intervene to get the yen down. Now, the market is unimpressed by all that talk, so the yen remains near a 15-year high against the U.S. dollar. Well, I wouldn't want to be long anything near a 15-year high, because common sense ought to suggest that even in a momentum trend, there's less additional upside than there is downside. I think probably the Asian currencies will remain among the steadier group. The U.S. and Europe, U.K., really don't want or need, or are unlikely to see, strong currencies overall, because their interest rates are going to stay low and their growth is going to be soft generally, and there are some sovereign debt concerns. So again, resources producers, currencies, Asian currencies generally, I think they are likely to remain firm overall, and I think the yen's likely to weaken. And that, good people, is the end of this long broadcast, and I wish you a splendid weekend, and I look forward to resuming commentaries on Monday. All the best.